Thank you, everyone. It's Wednesday, March 4th, 2020. This is the Labor Committee, called order at 2:30. Yes. You have the minutes of the previous meeting in front of you. Is there a motion? Representative Nelson.
I'll move approval of the minutes from February 26th, 2020.
Any additions or corrections to the previous minutes? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, we have a little, there is no alteration. Okay, we have House File 2971, Cantrell, Vocational Services for Individuals with Disabilities Provided and Reports Required. And I'll move, where's the number again? Yeah. Where's it going? I'll make a motion to advance this to Ed Policy. Is there an amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is.
Okay, I'll move the amendment. It's A1, moves to amend House File 2971. Is this what you need to get the bill into the shape you prefer?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I'll move that. Any discussion on this? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay, we have a bill in front of us. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2971 before you today. First off, the amendment that you all passed with my gratitude makes a couple technical changes based on feedback from DEED and DHS to ensure that we truly are putting together a bill and putting something forward that will be effective for achieving our desired outcome. So House File 2971, built on collaboration between DHS, DEED, and the Minnesota Department of Education to improve competitive integrated employment options for people with disabilities across the state of Minnesota. So we're speaking both within the Seven County metro area and in greater Minnesota as well. We put this bill together in order to ensure that the agencies, that the three respective agencies that I've mentioned, are working together in three ways to ensure that we are building a more inclusive society for people with disabilities in Minnesota. The first of these ways is that we want to ensure that the three agencies mentioned in this bill are partnering with stakeholders to create a plan to enhance competitive integrated employment opportunities for Minnesotans with disabilities, especially young adults and people with more significant support needs during critical transition age. So that's about 14 to 24, when children and young adults with disabilities are transitioning out of the structured K-12 school system and looking at what life in adulthood is going to look like for them. The second matter that we address in this bill is as part of this overall approach, we want the agencies to develop a plan, develop legislative recommendations to ensure that we are creating incentives, that we are creating a supportive structure in Minnesota to alleviate obstacles for folks with disabilities to access the full breadth of inclusive opportunities afforded to Minnesotans who aren't living with disabilities, whether that be an educational path or whether that be an integrated career track. And then the final point of this bill is that we want this task force to submit a data-driven report to the respective committees that will help inform the legislature's policy decisions when it comes to ensuring that that we don't simply say the progress that we've made so far to build a more inclusive society for folks with disabilities is enough, but it also take a look at what we can be doing better and how we can best implement those strategies to ensure that nobody is left behind and that as time goes on, that we reach an ever more inclusive society for Minnesotans living with disabilities. We need to make sure that Minnesotans with disabilities have access to as many supports and opportunities as possible in advancing their careers. This bill will help by advancing services helped to establish jobs at competitive wages at or above minimum wage, address some of the workforce shortages that we're struggling with across the state of Minnesota, and help to ensure that people with disabilities are fully able to access every opportunity to participate in a meaningful way in our economy and in our workforce. So more than 15 organizations across Minnesota have signed on in support of House File 2971. And with me today is John Alexander. He is the CEO of Kaposia. And he's going to offer some brief testimony and kind of help out in answering any questions that the committee might have. And I will say before I turn it over to John, Mr. Chair, as I said in this committee last week, this is part of an ongoing conversation, right? We as a state, we as a country, really do need to step up and do a more, I think, kind of focused job on ensuring that when somebody has a disability in our state, they are able to participate meaningfully and in an inclusive way in every facet of our society. So just as last week's bill is part of a conversation, so is this bill. So I appreciate your consideration, members of the committee, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Alexander.
Mr. Alexander, please identify yourself and title and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is John Alexander. I serve as a board member of the ARC Minnesota, also the co-president of the Minnesota Association of People Supporting Employment First, and in my day job, I'm the CEO of Kaposia. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 2971 today. Kaposia provides customized employment and retirement services to more than 300 individuals with disabilities as they build and advance their careers. At Kaposia, we partner with businesses of all sizes by helping them address workforce shortages, hire quality employees, build a more inclusive workforce, and ultimately be more profitable. We do this by matching and tailoring jobs that maximize the unique skills and interests and abilities of the people we support that fit the needs of the business. Every day, people with disabilities demonstrate their abilities in the workforce and make livable wages that foster their independence. Unfortunately, not all individuals with disabilities, especially those with more significant support needs, people who live in greater Minnesota, and people of color, have access to these types of tailored services that help achieve competitive integrated employment, as our current service infrastructure does not have the capacity to meet the demand. That's why we must build on current collaborative efforts between state agencies to expand access to and create incentives for these employment services. It's imperative that diverse stakeholders, including people with disabilities, their families, service providers, lead agencies, and business leaders, are at the table in this process. We have insights and capacity to lend innovative and creative ideas that will help move the system forward. Kaposia, Minnesota APSE, ARC Minnesota, and many other advocacy organizations and service providers who support this bill are ready to get to work with the departments and leaders in the legislature, such as yourselves, to get this done. We must raise the expectations of and for people with disabilities, promote their informed decision-making, shift understanding of what's possible in their careers, and leverage their talents to contribute to Minnesota's workforce and economy. I'm joined today by Kirk, a self-advocate who can speak directly to the importance of House File 2971 by sharing his lived experience with building a career that he enjoys with help from job coaching supports from LifeWorks.
Thank you very much. Who's next on your agenda?
That would be me.
Okay, please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Kirk Lanchin. I work at Peace Coffee. I've had my job for 3 years. This job is the first place I feel like I belong. While I've had important stepping stones along the way, like LifeWorks center-based program in Brooklyn Park, they weren't a great fit for me. Well, weren't a perfect fit for me, at least us. Since getting this job, I make minimum wage and work more hours than I used to, which is huge for me. This means I can be more independent. For a lot of people, work is mostly about the money. For me, it's more about being somebody who the company can depend on to get the job done right. I have unique skills and abilities that make me a good fit for almost any job. I can find ways to work fast while also getting the job done right. I'm very detail-oriented, so usually it takes me longer to really learn the job and fully understand it. But the end result is that I end up understanding things better than most people once I do learn them. LifeWorks was the one that helped me to get my job, and they continue to help me with any problems that I have on the job, which are few and far between. But every once in a while, I need to talk to my job coach to get through a challenge, and that's a service that I really appreciate. I can be down on myself sometimes, just like everyone else. And so being able to hold and keep a job boosts my mood and keeps me positive. And I hope that others will eventually be able to share in this feeling. I feel that it's important to understand that just because somebody has a disability doesn't mean that it will keep them from working well. In the end, that's the most important takeaway as far as I'm concerned. Thank you for your time today, and thank you for your support of this bill.
Thank you very much. You sound like an ideal employee.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for the author or the testifiers today? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cantrell, I appreciate what you are doing today, and I think it's a good goal. But I'm concerned, based on some of the media reports, that the Department of Human Services is so intimately involved in the development of the plans to expand opportunities and employment and prioritize and create incentives. When I read the Pioneer Press article about DHS being under scrutiny for treatment of employees with disabilities, I find that somewhat ironic that we're having this discussion while this is going on out there. Senator Hoffman and Senator Abler have been pretty outspoken in their criticism of DHS about the accommodation requests being lost in the bureaucracy and the DHS management slow walking accommodation requests. And they have a 70% agency approval rating, and statewide approval ratings is at 90%. So I don't know if they're developing this to improve the way they do things, why you included them in the bill, but there's a certain part of me that can't help but think that the fox may be guarding the hen house here. Help me out.
Representative Cantrell.
Chair Sundin, Representative Fabian, thank you so much for your very important question. Personally, I think it's unacceptable whenever people with disabilities, employees with disabilities, are treated poorly or unfairly. And so I think that, you know, that's a valid concern, I think, in all facets of our society, in all facets of our government. How can we be treating folks with disabilities with more fairness in the workplace? You mentioned Senators Abler and Hoffman. They're actually both authors on the bill in the Senate. So as far as is that concerned, I think their support for this bill indicates that that our fears that that there's something untoward happening as a result of this bill may be assuaged.
Any other further comments from the committee? Questions? Anybody in the audience who'd like to comment? Okay. Hearing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 2971 be re-referred to Education Policy.
Thank you.
As amended?
Yeah.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, you have a bill. Second up, we have Chair Moran, House File 3073. Chair Moran, we have in committee, we have House File 3073 before us. I will move 3073 be referred to Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. We also have an author's DE amendment before us. Please tell us about the amendment first.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Sundin and members. Thank you for the privilege to be here today to hear House File, 3073. So the amendment just really clarified the really specific population that we're working with in this bill. So it it clarifies that our current in current law we have a 12-week leave, right? But we're looking at specifically for birthing mothers to get move it from 12 weeks to 6 weeks to have time off after giving birth. So it's specifically for mothers who have given birth to get 6 weeks of unpaid leave. And so we want to just have that clarifying language in this bill. And so what I would talk a little bit more about why that is necessary.
Thank you. You have some testifiers that would like to weigh in on
this? Let me talk a little bit about the bill. But that's the amendment. Okay. All right.
All right. Thank you.
So House File 3073 is a quest to make unpaid maternity leave more accessible for birthing parents in the state of Minnesota. Currently in the law, a person needs to work at least 12 months in order to be eligible for 12 weeks of unpaid leave for childbirth, medical leave, adoption, etc. This bill changes that length of time from 12 months to 3 months, which is 90 days. And I guess you may say, why 3 months? Well, that is usually when an employee benefits kick in. It's an easy, simple alignment to currently how employees get benefits at that 90-day, 3 months time span. Although I know this is not a Health and Human Services committee, I want to share that the weeks after giving birth are an important period for both the parent and the infant in determining the health impact of long-term health and well-being of both the baby and the mother. As we know that women are in the workforce in greater numbers than ever, women are choosing to work and have a family. This really is a 21st century reality, and our state needs to move forward as such. Women, because of our current law, are being forced to go back to work too soon, jeopardizing not only their lives, but the lives of their child. So this bill is asking our state to protect the well-being of pregnant women, new moms, and babies, but also allow them to stay in the workforce and not have to choose between expanding their family and being the breadwinner or adding to that in their household. So with me, Mr. Chair, I have really the author of this bill who wants to really share why this is necessary and the impact of our current law, the impact that our current law had on her life and the dream job that she really worked so many years to accomplish.
Thank you. We can act on the DE right now. Is there any questions to the author or comments? Hearing none, all in favor of the DE amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Hearing none, we have an amendment in front of us. Go ahead with the testifying. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. Good afternoon. My name is Georgia Fort. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be here among you this afternoon. I went from news anchor to unemployed because I decided to have a baby. This was a position that I had worked for 10 years. My baby was delivered 11 months into my employment, and so I was not eligible for FMLA, missing the 12-month eligibility requirement by just a few days, losing not only my job, but my health insurance for myself, my unborn child, my husband, and my child that at the time was 10 years old. My termination at 9 months pregnant in the state of Minnesota was legal. I did my best to move forward. After all, I was a two-time Emmy-nominated journalist with 10 years of experience and a college education. How hard could it be to find another job, right? Although I received multiple job offers from companies in other states, no one in Minnesota would hire me in my field following my termination. Because I wanted to stay near family and my husband owns a business in St. Paul, I was forced to change career fields. My unemployment lasted about 9 months. I finally landed a position with the local government agency. When my husband and I found out we were expecting again, instead of being excited for having Irish twins, which are a handful, might I add, I was devastated because I again was not eligible for maternity leave. This time it was because the position was classified as temporary. This employer, however, had a different approach. Instead of being terminated, I was given 2 weeks to work from home. I was extremely thankful for the accommodation, but I found out quickly it was not an adequate amount of time off. No daycares would accept my two-week-old baby. As some of you may know, child care centers only take babies 6 weeks old and older. And the second issue with the two-week leave is that it goes against doctor's orders. So many of you may know, if you have families, if you have a baby, the doctor says, if everything goes well, 6 weeks off is the minimum. I returned to work on a Monday, and by Friday, I was rehospitalized. I was hemorrhaging. This is one of the leading causes of the reason why mothers are dying from childbirth. And so not only was I terrified for my life that Friday afternoon when I left my job and had to go back to the hospital, I was asking myself serious questions, like why had I compromised my own health and my own life just to maintain this position? And it was a temporary position at that. So I am here today to ask you, committee, is it a discriminatory practice to be fired because you are not eligible for maternity leave? Who is truly being dispositioned by this? I am here today to ask you, committee, how many other loopholes are there? Is there a task force designated to track the number of individuals who are legally terminated for not being eligible for childbirth leave? House File 3073 makes childbirth leave more accessible. After 90 days of employment, you're eligible for 6 weeks of unpaid leave. As Representative Moran stated, with 90 days, that's typically when you get all of your other benefits from your employer. So why would you not then get this unpaid leave, right? And why 6 weeks? Well, it's honoring what the doctor recommends without putting a financial burden on employers. And I will admit, we should consider this the minimum. In the future, we should do more, absolutely. But right now, we have to do something. Women are losing their lives. 33% are returning to work after taking no time off. And women are dying because of it. Providing adequate time off will improve health outcomes, and from a labor standpoint, I think it will improve retention. Companies will save thousands on recruiting and training by allowing mothers to return to work instead of terminating them, leaving positions vacant. Nearly 50% of the workforce is made up of women, and my concern for our workforce, if this continues, what's the incentive on being employed? Why not just go start your own business? I believe it is our human right to have a family. And in fact, that belief is supported by the Declaration of Human Rights. Despite FMLA considering pregnancy a medical condition, despite short-term disability considering pregnancy a disability, Article 16 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that it's a human right. Now, when you consider that America is the only industrialized country without paid maternity leave, we must truly ask ourselves then, why are we not at least offering unpaid time for mothers to recover and adequate time to raise their babies to an age where they can attend daycare? I do not believe that we're setting mothers up for success to participate in the workforce without this accommodation. In fact, after our last committee hearing, dozens of women reached out to me, three committed to coming today. One is in fear of losing their job if they speak out. The other is actually going into labor right now. And the third woman was able to make it today with her small baby.
Before we get started, do you have a page? Because I have some papers, some
there
information.
There should be a page.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Another testifier.
Maybe. Next testifier, would you please identify yourself and proceed?
Hi, it's an honor to be here before the committee. My name is Yonte Williams. I'm a lifelong resident of Minnesota and mother to a beautiful baby girl. I was offered a job at a call center near the end of my second trimester. They hired me knowing I was pregnant and offered a positive work environment and flexibility. I accepted the position and have since been surprised and disheartened by the complications of being a mother in the workforce. My employer additionally promised that I would retain my position after I returned from maternity leave. This was an empty promise. They had me submit required FMLA paperwork, which they neglected to process before my leave date. Despite my stellar performance and reliability, the company terminated my employment the week I went into labor. My amazing daughter is 2 months old next week. I've cherished and needed this time to breastfeed, learn how to be a mom, and introduce this new person to our world. I also lost a good-paying job, and I live in fear every day about how I'm going to pay my rent. I'm now relying on government assistance to put food on the table, and the stress takes a toll on me and my small family. I'm a hard worker, and all mothers are. Learning that my home state, who puts the notion of family on a pedestal, doesn't offer guaranteed leave for mothers, who make up 70% of the workforce of Minnesotans are under the current law, which does not go nearly far enough to ensure the financial security and physical health of women and children during the most formative and joyous moment in all of our lives. You have the power to relieve this traumatizing strain on our families. Sorry. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Todd Stanhope. I'm an OBGYN physician at North Memorial Health Hospital in Robbinsdale, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the American College of OBGYN, who supports this amendment, and we are grateful to Representative Moran for introducing this. In my position at North Memorial, I very commonly offer care for patients who are stuck in the dilemma that you just heard about. As you know, in the current form, there is 12 months of employment is required before the leave. If you do the math, 9 months is pregnancy. We often encounter women who become pregnant, decide they need to take on employment to prepare for family, but are often caught in a difficult situation wherein they're balancing the pregnancy as well as their employment, and also feel an almost fatalistic consequence of remaining employed as they realize that their employment is going to be terminated at the time of their delivery. Even for those patients who are able to plan for those 12 months, it's important to remember as well that not all pregnancies last 9 months. We commonly encounter patients who break their water in their second trimester and require prolonged hospitalization, or those who deliver early. I have commonly encountered patients admitted to our hospital who spend their time on the phone with employment, with their human resources personnel, trying to keep their job at a time when they should really be focused on their health and their baby's health. And in terms of the 6 weeks, I think a six-week minimum recovery time after childbirth is an important timeline, because recall as well that in the state of Minnesota, roughly a quarter of our patients deliver by cesarean. So not only is the mother caring for a newborn, who, as I can tell you with an 11-month-old right now, takes a lot of care, but they also have a surgical recovery. And so if they're going to return to an occupation that requires any type of physical labor or effort, that 6 weeks is critical to allow them a full recovery time. So I thank you all for consideration of this amendment, and I encourage you all to pass it.
Thank you. We have some input from the gallery as well, but we can go ahead with questions from the committee, comments. Representative Zhang.
Actually, I had a curiosity. I had a constituent who reached out to me a couple of weeks ago. She left, she worked for him in Hennepin County, left Hennepin County to come work for the state. She is eligible for unpaid leave, but she was not able to grandfather in her paid leave from the county. And I'm just curious, what about paid leave? Is that more of a federal issue? I'm not very familiar with FMLA, so I'm just curious.
Representative Moran.
Chair Sunday and Representative Zong, I don't think we don't have paid leave in the state of Minnesota, in the country. We do have unpaid leave, but as of now, we do not have paid leave at all.
Representative Zong?
Okay. I think I'm going to follow up because she mentioned to me that she was able to have some paid leave that she was not able to grandfather in because she will have to have a conversation with her bargaining unit. And so that's why I was just curious. Maybe it's not applicable to FMLA, but something else.
Okay. Let's see. You have
something to answer? May I speak?
Please.
I think, you know, as I stated during my testimony, that absolutely more needs to be done, and paid leave has been a conversation across the country. There are current bills right now advocating for paid leave. Certain employers may offer paid leave, which may have been the case for your constituent. An employer can offer paid leave, right? Companies, city, states can do more than what FMLA requires. Right now, the minimum, from my understanding of my research, is that the minimum that everyone has to abide by, whether you're a company, city, or state, is FMLA. And so if a company, city, or state wants to do more, like it sounds like there's people in Minnesota doing more, offering some type of paid leave, whatever the eligibility requirements are would vary. And so with this bill, it would set a different minimum. It would make the minimum accessibility requirement lower than what the federal requirement is. And it, I believe, a lot of the opposition for paid leave has been how it will disposition employers. My husband owns a business. We're not trying to present something that's going to disposition businesses or put them out of business. We are trying to say that women, especially women who partake in the workforce, deserve 6 weeks' time to recover, 6 weeks' time to get their baby to daycare. That's workplace equity. How do you, women cannot be expected to be successful in the workforce without this. We just can't. So I think that, yes, more should be done. I think it's great when there are companies out there, and hopefully your constituent can figure out how to get that benefit transferred, because that would be amazing. But I think with House File 3073, we're setting a very attainable minimum. It's the very bare minimum that will position mothers to be moms and also work.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of a shame we didn't do this bill last year, because then my baby could have been here with us. But what you said really kind of struck me, because that's exactly what happened to me, is when I found out I was pregnant, I was like, oh, no, I'm going to need more money. So wouldn't, you know, got a second job, and I was lucky that my supervisor was – it was predominantly women in my workplace, and so they had a little bit more of an understanding of what I was going through and were really accommodating. And then being here, also being able to bring my child with me last year was amazing. But I couldn't imagine, I was in the hospital for 8 days after I gave birth. I had a C-section and had lots of complications throughout the pregnancy and after. And my husband was able to take a month off to be home with me too. And I could not imagine, first of all, having to go back to work when, after I had just gotten out of the hospital, and without having support there. So I think it's not just women. We definitely need this. We have to have this. But I think we need also to, you know, we need men to have some of the time off too to help support us, because I don't know what I would have done without him there. So I just really thank you for bringing this forward and hope we can continue moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moran. The online on the DE1 amendment line 118. The 90 days, is that 90 work days or is it just calendar days?
I believe it's 90 calendar days.
90 calendar days. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions or comments to the testifiers or the author at this point? Seeing none, hearing none, we have someone in the gallery that would like to speak. Please come forward. Identify yourself and state your case.
My name is Sarah Piepenberg, and I am an owner of a small retail oil and vinegar store. I've actually been before you guys, a number of you, testifying for paid family and medical leave. But I'm here as a business owner in absolute support of this bare minimum human right. When it's illegal in the state of Minnesota to separate a kitten or a puppy before 8 weeks of age, it's absurd that we're just even setting this bar at 6 weeks. I'd like to see it more, but as a small business owner, this is something that we can get behind. And having my own story with my store's right next door to Dunn Brothers, I saw a customer's wife crying at Dunn Brothers. She had just started her job at Dunn Brothers and was told that they had overhired for part-time shifts. Interestingly enough, a week before, she had announced that she was pregnant. Being that it was November, I hired her immediately, being that we are going into our retail season, knowing full well that I was going to be able to give her 6 weeks of unpaid leave if she needed it. Sadly, she came back to me after 2 weeks wanting to work because financially she needed to. But this also speaks to the fact that we actually need, and small businesses are in support of, paid family and medical leave. But HF 3073 is a bare minimum, and as a small business owner, we can support this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other comments? The author, you have the last word.
So, Chair Sundin and members, I didn't check when these bills were enacted, but we know often they are outdated. And so 50 years ago, there was 18 million women in the workforce. Today, there are 66 million women in the workforce as of 2000. And so we really need to align our values of women being in the workforce, choosing to become mothers, choosing to be part of bringing in an income for their family. And currently, we don't have that. And it's completely unacceptable that in the 21st century, that we're making women make an unconscionable decision about giving birth and coming back to work in 2 weeks.
Thank you
very
much.
This is needed. So I hope we can have your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3073 as amended be re-referred to Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Okay, the motion prevails. Next up is House File 3467, Representative Morrison, taking a look at the state building code, adult size changing facility installation and public restrooms required. Representative Morrison, welcome to the committee. I will move your bill be re-referred to Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3467. This bill would require the installation of adult-sized changing tables in newly constructed and remodeled public restrooms to accommodate children and adults with disabilities or special needs to ensure safer, cleaner, and more dignified accommodations for everyone. And with that, I want to turn the microphone over to my incredible constituent, who is both an architect and an advocate and who brought the idea for this bill to me.
We love professionals. Please state your name, your profession, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members, for having me here today. My name is Sarah St. Louis. I am the architectural and building profession, which I have been in for more than 20 years. Actually, I've been in it my whole life because my father is a builder. I've worked in both residential and commercial architecture and currently work for a major Fortune 500 Minnesota-based company as their associate manager of architecture, overseeing almost 1,000 stores across our country. My job literally affects the lives of millions of people every day, and that is a responsibility that I take very seriously. Most importantly, I am the mother of two boys with disabilities. Traven is 18, he is gifted, and has severe depression and anxiety. Ezra is 8 years old, and he has physical, intellectual, and cognitive disabilities and a seizure disorder because of a severe traumatic brain injury he received in 2013. The reason I am here advocating for this bill today is because I believe that all persons are deserving of love, dignity, respect, and full inclusion within our society, and it is our responsibility to make sure this happens. When I was in design school, I had an instructor tell me, as I was studying the ADA, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, that whatever we design that is good for those with disabilities is even better for everyone else. Always strive for better. Today I am asking you to strive for better as well today as passing HF 3467. For my career, and since my son Ezra's accident in 2013, I have been fervently advocating for change in my profession, and in our government to make our buildings and our communities fully accessible and inclusive to all members of our society. This includes adult-sized changing tables and public restrooms for those with disabilities, complex medical needs, and those over the age of 2 or 30 pounds that do no longer fit on an infant changer. In 2017, we were lucky enough to attend a Minnesota Twins game with a family we had met during our inpatient time at Gillette. Their son, Aiden, also has a severe traumatic brain injury, is nonverbal and nonmobile due to simply having the flu. He is completely dependent on others to meet his every need. The Minnesota Twins do lots of charity work with Gillette Children's and numerous other groups that serve those with disabilities and complex medical needs, including veterans. This amazing and beautiful stadium was built, but no one bothered to ask what the needs of those who attend the games are. My friend was forced to put her 10-year-old son on a dirty bathroom floor in the family restroom in order to change her son, not once, not twice, but 3 times during that game. Her son's health was compromised by being placed on this dirty bathroom floor. And her health was harmed by having to lift this child in and out of his chair and onto the floor. And the dignity they lost and the degradation they endured and continue to is unacceptable. Quite honestly, it is downright embarrassing that this is how we treat the most vulnerable in our state, and we should all be ashamed. I vowed that day to change restrooms in our state to meet the needs of all persons in our state. Currently, California, Arizona, and New Hampshire have laws on their books requiring these in their public spaces, and several other states are debating this issue currently. The cost of these are in line with an infant changer, which ranges a current infant changer is between $250 and $1,200. you can get a basic table, adult-sized changing table, for around $500. And that way, everybody can use it. And let me ask you, committee, how much is your dignity worth to you? Do you find it acceptable to have yourself be put down on a dirty bathroom floor to be changed or other needs met? If not, how can you possibly find it acceptable for those with disabilities, complex medical needs, or simply over the age of 2 to be placed on a dirty bathroom floor? Again, I ask you, how much is your dignity worth to you? Thank you for your time, and I'm open for any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Can you, who's the next testifier? Please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Kozel, and I'm a mother of an amazing son, Noah, who's 11 years old and a strong disability advocate. I strongly support HF 3467. My son Noah has autism. Like with other disabilities, public restrooms have been a challenge for our family. The struggles we have faced and are facing today are humiliating, degrading, and frankly disgusting. The thought of having to change my child or my elderly parents on a dirty bathroom floor is it, or simply just being excluded from participating in our communities is horrifying. It's discrimination, and it should not happen to anyone. In my son's current public school, which they've just done a bonding bill for, they aren't thinking about family bathrooms, and that is very concerning to me, such as community education. Classes take place in public places, including public schools. I just found out about this within the last week. Even at our own state capitol, the People's House, it's not really for all people of the state. Our state building should be a place where all constituents should be able to meet with their legislators, participate in hearings like this one, or attend events. But they simply cannot, simply because as a state, we've decided that those with disabilities and complex needs are not fully welcomed here, not fully human enough to participate. Their personal needs to be challenged because of incontinence issues, which incontinence issues can range from 0 to 110, tube changes, catheter needs, wound care, changing of clothes that's soiled, or given certain medications that have been and continue to be ignored and discarded as not human enough to be included to be participating in our communities or state government. My child is on TEFRA. He gets a CDCS waiver, which means part of that is to be able to go out in the community and do things to get him more independent, to have play dates. And that's, it's really hard when you have a child or a mother-in-law with incontinence issues. They don't want to leave their house because they're worried about the bathroom. I'm pleading with you today, Chairman and committee members, to move this bill forward all the way to Governor Walz's desk and to assign a new state law in order for members of our state to be shown dignity, respect, and full inclusion within all of our communities and our state governments, because disability rights are a human right, and we are not all without all of us. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you very much. We see another testifier. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Trem Nguyen, and I'm 47 years old and a proud mom and full-time caregiver to my daughter, Sadie. My sweet Sadie is 4.5 years old and has been diagnosed with multiple disabilities. Sadie is deafblind, epileptic, nonverbal, eats via feeding tube, and has significant delays both cognitive and physical development. She is wheelchair dependent and will always be diapered. Sadie thrives on environments that can give her tactile and auditory stimulation, since she is able to hear some with her hearing aids and can see some with her glasses. She loves loud music and bright lights, such as going to the Wild and Timberwolves games. She smiles so brightly when she comes into the stand and she hears the loud cheers. Other places that she also enjoys is places like the Mall of America, the Nickelodeon Park. All these places, though, do not have adult-sized changing tables or any tables in their family lounge areas. This is a major problem for Sadie and thousands like her. At 4.5 years old, Sadie weighs almost 40 pounds and is too long to fit on a baby changing table. My only options are to bring a yoga mat and lay her on the floor at the bathroom stalls, or find a place that is clean and semi-private outside of the bathroom. None of these options are ideal. They're uncleanly, gives her no privacy, and she's only going to get older and become a young lady. And it's not good for my back to lift her off and off the ground. You want me as healthy as possible so that I can keep caring for my sweet Sadie. Many parents also with children with special needs already struggle with isolation, depression, and anxiety as our kids are fragile. But not having a clean and secure space where we can change our growing kids or adult children just adds to our stress levels and inhibits our ability to create as normal of a life as possible with the challenges we already face. I find myself bypassing opportunities to meet my friends with able-bodied kids because I know I can't change her when she has a big blowout. Being homebound takes away from Sadie's ability to flourish and is not good for her mental, for my mental health. This problem doesn't just affect families with kids like Sadie. We have a growing aging population, and some adults need assistance in diapering. I've experienced this firsthand because my father fell ill at 65 to a rare autoimmune disease called scleroderma. He briefly had to be diapered before he passed. My father already felt a lot of his dignity was lost by having to be diapered, and then having to sit in a wet diaper because we had nowhere to change him was even more salt to the wound. I urge you please to help thousands of families like mine living in Minnesota by passing Bill 3467, requiring public places to have adult-sized changing tables. Because this allows people who have never had to think about these opportunities, many of you don't have a child with a disability or a parent maybe that has it. This won't require someone to just think about it. This will require that they have to do it. So allowing us to do this will allow us to get out into the communities and make human connections and thrive as families. Thank you, Chairman and Committee, for hearing my testimony, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you very much to all the testifiers. You've shared some very compelling stories with us, and I'm certain there's a couple of questions because I have them. I would ask first, I don't know what adult-sized changing table looks like. Is there an industry standard? I'd like to see a picture of that at some point as this bill develops and goes through the hoops. And cost-wise, what does it cost to install per unit, I guess?
Thank you, Chairman, for your question. It is a good one. You can get, there are varying degrees of options for adult-sized changing tables. They can be as basic as something that looks like a massage table, which are around, they can start about $500. And that's just simply putting that in. That's the one of the cheaper ways to do it. They can go up to $10,000 when they have all the bells and whistles, the remotes to move up and down. Chicago O'Hare Airport has what I would consider a dream public restroom for those with disabilities. There is an article which I can make sure that all of you committee members get. It shows a shower, sink, one of the high-end changing tables, and all the bells and whistles. I'm just asking for basics. I want us to get something through the door so people in our state can have some level of dignity and respect. But they do vary, and I can certainly get you all that information sent over to you.
Thank you. I'll repeat my question about an industry standard.
Industry standard. Currently, no. There is no industry standard for an adult-sized changing table. There are recommendations of what they should be at. As it's kind of laid out, I put the bare minimums in this bill that are in here, such as the size being a minimum of 24 inches by 71 inches, the height of it to be able to transfer somebody from a chair to this table. Those kind of things are what would be considered minimum for those states that have already passed this bill and those that are negotiating adding it to their state laws.
Thank you. I would just be interested in seeing what those standards are that the other states are using, a little bit of a guide for us to do this right.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And cost-wise, I don't know. We leaned on, let me turn to the right here and ask Representative Meckland if he's ever been involved in this type of changing station.
Thank you, Chair. No, I have not. I've never even heard of these. So we did Google it. Yes, we kind of, all the ones that pop up are the $3,000 and $10,000 range. One thing I would be, you say in any remodeled bathroom as well. What if there's not room?
To the testifier.
Thank you, Chairman. That is an issue. But I really feel like any other remodel project that we do and the company that I work for, we make room because this is important, because there's 80 million people in our country that have disabilities. And on average, those people have at least two people in their lives that care about them. That becomes 240 million people. 240 million people have buying power. 240 million people have voting power. So to say that, make excuses that it doesn't fit, it means that you really don't want certain shoppers in your building or your business. And in our state buildings, that's not an excuse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meckland.
Thank you. I understand that we do have historic buildings that simply don't have room. So I would hate to get us into a pickle where someone wants to remodel to bring something up to make it better, and they're going to actually put it off. And the other thing I would suggest, I mean, like looking through this, how do we avoid somebody literally building something really rickety just to be compliant, and then we don't have sanitary surfaces? There should be some guidelines so we don't literally have like something that could actually be dangerous. So if you want to incorporate that as this thing moves on, that was one thought I had.
Thank you, Representative Meckland, for those thoughts. I think there's a little bit of homework to do before the next committee stop. I hope so.
Yes.
I'd like to see some more complete thoughts on, you know, the physical presence of that table and the cost as well. So
absolutely.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, on line 3.14, it says changing facilities on each floor where there is a restroom accessible to the public. What if I have a multiple floor business? Would under the current, if this was passed, if I wanted to put in a changing room, say in maybe two floors, and make it a special room just for this, I wouldn't be able to do that according to this on line 3.14.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question?
The question was, on line 3.14 says, a changing facility on each floor where there is a restroom accessible to the public. Let's say if I had a business that had several floors and I felt I could afford to put one on maybe one floor, two floors or whatever, and make it a special changing room for that. But under the, if this would pass this way, I wouldn't be under the code then.
Well,
the testifier.
Thank you, Chairman. The intention is that either you have a separate, inclusive, gender-neutral restroom mm-hmm. where you could do this, or you have them in both the men's and the women's. Now, there is a movement in the architectural community, including here in Minnesota with St. Paul Public Schools has already done it, is getting rid of men's and women's restrooms and having simply standalone individual stalls. And then having that in the accessible stall would be an option to do that in. Okay. Because actually when you do that, it actually lowers the plumbing costs and costs of having restrooms.
And Mr. Chair, I think we have a good bill that's in a work in progress. So I think your comments before are well taken.
Thank you. Any other comments from the committee? Two more. Representative Nelson.
And I'm not sure if this is for the author or who. So this would be, if if I'm understanding this, if there's a, this would be triggered when a permit is pulled for doing a remodel. If I'm understanding it correct, we had a discussion similar about a week ago about baby changing stations. And so I'm assuming this is when a permit is pulled to be do a remodel or something, so it wouldn't require an immediate remodel of a bathroom to fit, you know, it would, as something is changed, if I'm understanding.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Any further questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Morrison, you've been up in my part of the state, and you've seen some of our public buildings. You've been in the arena in Roseau. You've used the ladies' bathroom there. I don't know how we make this work in some of these really small towns. Our cafes are tiny. I appreciate what is going on here, but as the chair has said, I think that there's some work to do here. But I'm curious about the comment about the O'Hare Airport. Mm-hmm. And you said it's a state of the art. And O'Hare is big. I've been there. How many of those do they have in the O'Hare Airport? Boy, try saying that fast three times, Representative Hornstein.
As far as I know, they only have the one big room of that for that option there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. Any other comments, questions to the testifier? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, how many square feet are we talking for a bathroom here? Because, you know, it is difficult when, and I've remodeled a few older, or not myself, but I've worked with design on remodeling older buildings. And the problem there is, of course, the square footage that you have available to utilize to do something. And I'm just curious, you know, generally I figure maybe about 65 square foot for the handicap bathroom or whatever. What are we looking at here?
To the author.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we have it outlined in the bill with the minimum 24 inches wide and 71 inches long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I was looking for the amount of square feet that the bathroom would need to be. In other words, you know, you could do a bathroom in probably 35 square feet, but to make it ADA, I think I usually figure about, you know, 65 or something. How much is this going to add? Because it wouldn't be just a normal bathroom anymore. You'd have to have this an additional piece and space for it to flip down and all of that.
Good question. Can you fill us in on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm deferring to my architectural partner here, and she says between 80 and 120 square feet.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, just to get the perspective of the agency on this bill. Going to have oversight.
Is there anyone from the agency that wishes to weigh in, please? Please identify yourself and proceed.
Yep. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the state building official and the director of construction codes and licensing for the state of Minnesota.
I could ask a question, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Well, certainly, Representative Fabian.
I don't want him to necessarily, if you want to, just extemporaneously speak to this, but mm-hmm. I guess the first question I would have is probably back to Representative Morrison and you too, Mr. McClellan, is what conversations have you had between yourself and Representative Morrison, because you're obviously going to have enforcement and other things to do with this bill?
Mr. McClellan.
Yep, Mr. Chair and Representative. We did send some written comments to the Representative regarding some of the issues that should be considered. One, there is an increase of square footage. There's no question about that. We have a staff architect as well who did some calculations that it may add from 15 square feet to over 20 square feet to an existing, what we call family or family assisted restroom, which is currently required in our building code in very large occupancies, large retail, stadiums, malls, large churches, where there's a certain amount of fixtures you might see what's called a family or assisted restroom for these purposes. So from the department standpoint, if the legislature was considering something like this, it would make most sense to require it in that type of facility. And in those instances, in those occupancies, you only you would install one family assisted in a building of that size in new construction. Right.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you. To the author, close it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing the bill, and we appreciate the feedback and are willing to work with the department and work with both sides of the aisle to construct a bill that will help make our community more accessible to all Minnesotans. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for the bill. Hearing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3467 be re-referred to the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Division. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank Next you. Up, we have House File 3601. Representative Noor is going to talk to us about credit information requirement for use by employers as employment condition prohibited. Representative Noor, welcome to the committee. I will move your bill be referred to the General Register. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my motion. House File 3601 addresses a major issue when it comes to employers or prospective employers from requesting or using credit information, including employee or prospective employee's credit score, credit history, credit account balances, payment history, savings or checking accounts balances, or saving or checking account numbers. For any hiring, firing, deciding employment terms and conditions for an employee or job applicant. This bill provides exceptions for certain types of positions. The bill provides enforcement through private course of action. As you all know, in this job market, we're looking for many employees. So we've got 150,000 jobs. As studies have shown, credit score is not relevant to employment when it comes to background credit check. And quite frankly, many employers are commonly using background check and a source of credit information on employees. It creates barriers to opportunities and upward mobility. Quite frankly, it creates discrimination for so many members of many communities and can lead to invasion of privacy. Mr. Chair and members, there are many factors that are outside an individual's control and have no reflection on someone's moral character or their ability to adequately perform their jobs. Rather, credit checks are unfair and discriminate against the long-term unemployed and other disadvantaged groups. Credit report reveals a great deal of information about an individual, including personal financial information or history. They also provide a window into even more deeply private information about an individual, such as medical history, divorce, and many other factors. And Mr. Chair and members, some employers may even further use that information for their own advantage to intimidate employees when it comes to knowing that they've acquired a private information that was not relevant to their employment. I was approached by a member, by a constituent who was actually denied employment just basically because of their credit history. It's someone who should have been employed, but because they had high student loans, because they had so many balances on their account, and the job that they applied, they were denied. According to a study by DEMO, one in four respondents who are unemployed say a prospective employer has requested a credit check as part of job application. And one in 10 respondents who are unemployed say they have been told they will not be hired for a job because of information in their credit report. And also, one in 7 of all respondents who have poor credit say they have been told they will not be hired for a job because of information on their credit report. So, Mr. Chair and members, 3601 is in reference to make sure that we are able to provide that protection for those individuals who have got poor credit When it comes to employment, it has got nothing to do with their ability to perform their job. So I'm asking for your support on this bill so that we can provide that layer of protection for employee or prospective employees. And there's also some exceptions that I've already is in the bill that will allow financial institutions, credit unions, if it's required by the federal government or the state. So that is already included as an exception in the bill. Mr. Chair and members, I'll be glad to answer any questions that you have about this information.
Thank you, Representative Noor, to the committee. Any questions, discussion on this bill? Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, one moment. That's your question. You know, as I read this over, I'm wondering if it needs at least to go to civil law from the standpoint that it's initiating a civil action. And also, you know, we're getting into some banking issues here as well, some employment issues. So the question is, maybe it makes a few more stops and gets refined a little bit before it goes to the floor.
Just thank you, Representative Vogel. Can we look to council for some input on something like this?
Chair and members, the question is whether it should go to other committees.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Noor.
I have sent a request to Chair Lesh to see if he wants in his committee. He has not given me, but I think the last section when it talks about the private right of action is something that could be taken to the judiciary if that is necessary to look into. But according to him, it's not necessary at this point, but we can always send it to the judiciary to refine it and send it to the registry.
Where is he standing?
My thoughts here, Representative Noor, is to in fact send it to civil law. I think that might be a prudent thing to do, and they might shed some daylight on the issue as far as any actions that could result from this. So any further discussion, I'm going to modify my motion. Any further comments?
Nothing. I will hope that the committee will approve to send it to the judiciary, and we can refine the private action, private course of action, if necessary. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Hearing no further discussion, I'm going to alter my motion and modify it to send this 3601 to civil law. For further consideration. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chen, members.
That completes our business for today. Thank you. We're adjourned.